When President Barack Obama was elected in 2008, Americans congratulated themselves for entering a post-racial period. But when Donald Trump was elected just 8 years later, in part because he encouraged racial animus and white grievance, Americans had to admit that racism is very much and unfortunately alive and well. To better understand racism in America, it is essential to dive into the race-based slavery that was the backbone of our economy for more than 200 years. In his latest book, The Great Stain, Witnessing American Slavery, published by Overlook Press, Noel Ray stitches together firsthand accounts into a narrative history that brings the reader face to face with the slavery's everyday reality. Noel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, there's so much to tackle here. I wanted to start at the very beginning. You open the book exploring the definition of a slavery that William Wells Brown, a black abolitionist, gave in a speech on the subject in 1847. How did he define it?
I agree with Mr. Brown.
And what was the definition he gave?
Oh, he says, what is a slave? Well, I don't have the book in front of me, but he said a slave is a nothing. He doesn't belong to himself. He has no rights over his family. His children can be sold.
Right.
His labor, he works very hard. He gets nothing for it. And that's essentially, he's a chattel.
Chattel, that was the key
chattel?
Word.
A chattel, according to me, is a piece of furniture, something, a movable piece of property. That's it.
A movable piece of property.
Yeah.
You write, long before the term slavery was defined, the fact of slavery had existed in almost every part of the world and in almost every part of recorded history, including our present time. So maybe tell us about contemporary slavery. I mean, this is enduring.
I'm sorry, I can't really tell you about that because I don't know about that.
Yeah.
I know about slavery up to emancipation,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know afterwards.
And you note that for most of history, nobody saw anything wrong with slavery. I mean, there was actually even
yes.
Christian context for this, right?
Absolutely right, yes. Not until the Enlightenment. That was when things really started to change, and you had the ideas that men were born free, Rousseau and Locke and Jefferson. This was the idea then that slavery was morally wrong.
So does that mean that before that time, most people subscribed to the idea that some people were meant to be masters and others slaves?
Yes, I think pretty much.
Tremendous.
If you were a slave, you were unlucky, but you were not the victim of injustice.
Mm-hmm. So in 1938, when President John Quincy Adams called slavery, quote, a deadly disease, the great and foul stain upon the North American Union, in this regard, I guess he was ahead of his time.
Well, it was actually 1838.
Okay.
And no, he wasn't ahead of his time. That was then the great change in thinking in outside the South. The South had closed their minds on this topic.
And you mentioned this sort of coming out of the Enlightenment, but was this sort of when did this come to the U.S. in terms of thinking in U.S. leadership?
In the about slavery?
Yeah.
Well, I guess with the independence, the War of mm-hmm. Independence, the idea of freedom came to the front, and therefore it was an idea that knew no bounds and was therefore extended to, if it applies to us, white Americans, what about slaves too? And from then it took off.
So how did you first get interested in studying slavery?
I started on another book. I was going to do a book about discovering America and the immigrant stories. And when I was reading it, I came across this story about a description of life on a slave ship by a ship surgeon called Alexander Falconbridge, who later testified for the British Abolition Society. And his description of what it was like on a slave ship is absolutely horrendous. It was riveting. So that I then started to read more about slavery, and I set that first book aside and went into slavery. And I found then that there really is no book that tells slavery primarily from the point of view of those who actually engage in it, primarily, of course, the slaves themselves, but also the owners, the masters, the apologists, the abolitionists.
So it's really a sort of on-the-ground reporting in as much as one can do it in a historic
context. As close as possible, yes.
There were as you said, there are so many books on the subject of slavery and none really that go about it this way.
Yeah.
How did you go about tracking down the primary sources?
Well, I read all the big books that are out there, all the academic books, plowed through them. And then I went to their bibliographies, and I went to the bibliographies where they got their original material mm-hmm. from. And one thing led to another. And there's a vast amount of material out there.
We know that knowledge is power and that slave owners in America deliberately prevented their slaves from learning to read and to write. Hasn't that led to a dearth of sources from the perspective of the slaves?
At first, absolutely, yes, there was. Very sadly, of the, as I mentioned, something like 10 million slaves were shipped across the Atlantic. And we have the records of about 10 or 11 out of 10 million. That's it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an infinitesimal...
Yeah, I'll say.
Perspective. You set about to answer one central question: what was slavery like? But first, you describe the history of slavery in Africa, and you write about four distinct branches of slavery in the slave trade in Africa, and all of them date well before the Christian era. What were the four distinct branches?
There was domestic slavery, whereby people more or less stayed where they were. It was often as a result of borrowing money. You would pledge a member of your family to the person who lent you money, and if you couldn't pay it back, that person became a slave. But they became a member of the lender's family. They were not exploited usually in the way that other slaves were. There was the trans-Indian Ocean slave trade, which was which went up the east coast of Africa and across to India and as far as China. And that was run by Arabs. There was the trans-Saharan slave trade, which went from West Africa up on foot across the Sahara Desert up to the Barbary Coast. And then there was the Barbary Coast people, Tripoli, and whose pirates went raided all around the coast of the Mediterranean, out into the Atlantic. They raided Ireland, they raided Iceland.
It almost feels like the first form of globalism. You use the word benign to describe some forms of slavery in Africa, though not on the continent's east coast, I think. How was slavery on the west coast benign? Or it was west coast where you said it was benign.
Well, when it was domestic slavery.
Okay.
When people were not moved from their villages or areas, but just went to work and lived with somebody else.
And John Newton is quoted that in addition to the loss of life, there was, quote, the dreadful effects of this trade upon the minds of those who are engaged in it. In general, I know of no method of getting money, not even that of robbing for it upon the highway, which was so direct a tendency to efface the moral sense, to rob the heart of every gentle and humane disposition, and to harden it like steel against all impressions of sensibility. That's tremendous. And so you have a lot of perspectives from people that were involved in the slave trade, yes?
The people who actually operated in the slave trade, the common sailors, it was absolutely, it was very harsh conditions for them. They died at a rate almost as high as those of the slaves on the crossing. The captains had an interest in the slave trade, so they benefited, so they were exploiters. And the traders at the other end, sort of in the West Indies, I don't know all that much about them, but they too were just commercial money only.
I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Noel Ray about his book, The Great Stain, Witnessing American Slavery from Overlook Press. So whose accounts, in terms of the people who were involved in the trade, whose accounts were you able to capture?
Well, for the trade, okay, there were a number of English ship captains, Captain Phillips, one who kept a very close diary and detailed of how it operated, and there were two or three others. John Newton was another one, who before he gave it up, as he got religion,
right.
And so enough, not very many. I'm sure there were others. I'm sure there were Portuguese slave traders. There were in fact many Portuguese, but I could not access them.
You write that, quote, of the millions who were taken captive and sent across the ocean, only a handful ever had the chance to tell their story. And often their story is the only thing we know about them. Not even their names have survived. Yeah. Most of the Africans at this time didn't have written languages, but you did have Gustavus Vasa, I believe is the name. How did he describe life before the Europeans arrived?
Oh, well, that was one of the great books. Gustavus Vasa was the name foisted upon him by one of his owners. His real name was Ola Uda Equiano, and he was an Ubo, and he wrote a wonderful book, the narrative of his life, which gives a very, very vivid and living description of life in Africa before he was captured as a small boy and carried off into slavery.
And he brought he was always literate? He was literate as a child? Or?
No. He got very, very lucky. Shortly after he arrived in South Carolina, he was picked up by an English captain, a captain of an English ship, taken to England, landed up with a fairly kindly family who gave him an education. And he also acquired his freedom later on.
And how did he describe life before the Europeans arrived?
Oh, very nice. It was very sort of peaceful, idyllic, quiet, harmonious. I think he perhaps, you know, gave a rather overly favorable picture of what it was like, but it did seem, I let that run because there was this myth cultivated by the slave owners of darkest Africa, full of cannibals who ate each other, mm-hmm. and savage wars and horrible rituals. Mm-hmm. And it was not like that.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any real sense of, you mentioned 10 million people involved in the trade. Where does that number come from? And
oh, well, the English abolitionists, mm-hmm. when they got going in the late part of the 18th century, they went very carefully into this matter, and they persuaded the British government to appoint a committee of inquiry. It was the Privy Council, and they went into this, and that's where they came up with these figures, which I quote, of how many died on the various parts and stages of the from being captured to arriving in the West Indies.
Mm-hmm. And so the 10 million estimated to be involved in the trade, how many did die during the journey?
Oh, about 12%. Oh, just on the crossing. Mm-hmm. On the crossing. I mean, but nobody knows how many die between being captured or killed in the wars that raised slaves. Nobody knows, or waiting on the coast. That was about 5% died, 12% on the crossing. And then during the first year, when they were put to work incredibly hard, they just died about approximately 30%.
Mm-hmm. In your chapter, Personal Stories, you tell the story of an anonymous friend of Charles Ball. Yeah. Tell us who he is.
Who's Charles Ball?
Yes.
Oh, he was a slave who was many years, 50 years in chains, and he finally escaped and became free. And he told the story of this anonymous friend of his who was chased by a lion, uh-huh. in the desert. A very dramatic story.
And where was he captured?
I don't know exactly because he doesn't say.
Yeah.
But it was somewhere in the Sahel, the different between the West Africa and the Sahara. There's this scrubby district.
Was he a Muslim?
Yes, because that's how, because they knew him Muslim because five times a day he turned to Mecca, mm-hmm. to pray.
Mm-hmm. And what was his reaction to seeing his first white person?
That was when he'd been captured and taken down to the coast.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they saw these horrible people.
Yeah.
You know, very ugly with their white skins and their red faces and their pale hair, pale eyes. Monstrous. You know.
And tell us a little bit about how he described the journey to America.
Oh, Equiano?
Yeah.
He was lucky because he was very small. He was a boy and he was 12 years old. So he was not confined in shackles below decks with the others. He was kept alive. He was allowed to roam free on the deck and among the women. And he was sort of taken up and petted by the women on board the ship. So he was lucky. He was well looked after. But he couldn't be sold. He was too small for sale in the West Indies. So they sent him on to Virginia.
And what was his ultimate fate?
Ultimately, he wanted to become a missionary back to West Africa, but they wouldn't ordain him. He became very active in the English Abolitionist Society.
And you tell the story of another African Muslim who came to a happy end, Job Ben Solomon. Tell us about him.
Yeah, well, he was a high priest, and he was captured and enslaved and sent to Maryland. And it was discovered that he was a literate person. He was arrested because he went off, and they found that he could read. Mm-hmm. So that right away meant that he was an educated person. So he happened then to meet some Maryland gentlemen who took an interest in him, and they got this. And they wrote a letter to the Royal African Society in London, and a very complicated story. And he was eventually redeemed and went back to his country. One in millions and millions.
Where was he originally from?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I should know.
Yeah. You also tell the story of a relatively fortunate slave, as you put it, Luis Asa Asa?
Yes.
Where was she from?
He was a boy. He was captured, and he was put on a French ship, and the French ship ran into a storm and was shipwrecked on the coast of Cornwall. And so then the Abolitionist Society heard about him. They got a writ of habeas corpus, because slavery does not exist in England. So he was freed. He was taken up by, and he became a servant in a well-to-do family, and was quite well treated. assassinated. That's as far as we know about him. What happened to him later in life, I don't know. It's not recorded.
But he ended up in England, yes?
Oh, yes, yeah.
And you write that New England, as far back as the early 17th century, was out of step with the rest of the country and the world on the issue of slavery. What did the colonists of Massachusetts make of the idea of slavery?
That was okay. They had the Cotton Mather, the leading New England's leading divine. He had a slave called Onesimus, who didn't work out very well because he was rather a rebellious slave. Mm-hmm. But they were domestic servants. They were not slaves out on the farms because they didn't need slaves. It was a different kind of agricultural system, small farms. Mm-hmm. It didn't work very well in Boston because there was racism already, mm-hmm. right away.
And you mentioned Cotton Mather. I mean, there was a lot of, there's a lot captured in the book in terms of theological debates. Yes. In the colonial context. Right. Tell us about some of the main players and sort of those arguments.
Well, the great authority until the Age of Reason was the Bible. Mm-hmm. Everybody said, what's right? You look to the Bible. Well, you could read the Bible any way you like, pretty much. And those the abolitionists read the Bible and said slavery is wrong, it's a sin, and those apologists for it said, look, Abraham had slaves, and Jesus never said slavery was wrong, and St. Paul said servants obey your masters, and servants, they said, meant slaves. So they said, look, the Bible is on our side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because most of the scripture about slavery comes from the Old Testament, yeah? But it's interesting that they would take sort of an absence of language from Christ.
He didn't mention it. Uh-huh. Therefore, it was okay.
Yeah.
That was the implication.
Yeah, yeah. And Cotton Mather, where did he fit into this discussion?
Well, he was New England's prime religious person, and he was a great proponent of the Salem witch trials, and he thought slavery was perfectly all right because the Bible says it was okay. So mm-hmm. he did, as I say, he had a slave. It didn't work out.
There was the funny thing is you have this this whole discussion going on about the theology around slavery, but then there was the treatment of the Native Americans in the same time, right?
Yeah, but on the other hand, they set out to convert the Native Americans. When they were telling themselves the story about the Puritans, one of the things is, why did we come? We came here in order to convert the woe-begotten Indians to bring them light. Mm-hmm. To save their souls.
Was the idea to convert the Native Americans present before the idea to convert slaves, or was that
No, it was an afterthought. You know, they decided they came because for various reasons, but they didn't come in order to convert the Indians. They that was an afterthought. Mm-hmm. And John Eliot was the apostle to the Indians, and he didn't get very far.
Mm-hmm. I'm D.W. Gibson, and I'm speaking with Noel Ray about his latest book, The Great Stain, Witnessing American Slavery, from Overlook Press. I'm D.W. Gibson, and I'm speaking with Noel Ray about his book, The Great Stain, Witnessing American Slavery, from Overlook Press. So tell me, what was it like to research all of this? I mean, you're cobbling together just thousands of pages of material.
Indeed. Yeah, oh, it took me years and years and years. I read and read and read, and I compiled an immense amount of material, which I then had to winnow and winnow and winnow. And so I had to find stuff. Since I decided to make a continuous story, I had to. Some stuff was very hard to find. Early African explorers wasn't so bad because mm-hmm. the Portuguese had that all recorded. It was the hardest finding the good slave stories because there was such a dearth of material coming from them, because they were the laws which said it was a crime to teach a slave to read. Mm-hmm. So only when in the earlier part of the 19th century, when the abolitionist movement got going, that you had a real interest to collect slave narratives.
And did you know from the beginning how you were going to organize the book? I mean, you do it quite chronologically. No,
I didn't.
Yeah.
No, you don't. Not for, I'm sure some of the better organized mind would have done. But I got the stuff, and then I found it, and then a sort of shape emerged.
Uh-huh.
It's basically chronological.
Yeah. And tell me about how it compared to doing your other books. This is not your first rodeo.
It's not. Well, actually, I have to put the other books are much the same. My first book, Witnessing America, was a compilation of first-person sources showing what life was like, everyday life in the country. My second book, which was something of a flop, was about the Revolutionary War. And again, I got lots and lots of first-hand sources, not just from the patriot point of view, but also the loyalists. Mm-hmm. And the Hessians and the Indians and of course the poor British soldiers who had to rather reluctantly fight that war.
Right. So how did you see this book in the context of your other work? I mean, how does it relate to?
Well, it's just the same method. My great interest is in hearing the original voices, is getting as close as possible to the sense of what it was actually like to be there. Mm-hmm. To snuff the gunpowder.
Why do you think there hasn't been a book like this before? I mean, so many books on slavery, right? Why do you think this was a void?
Well, it's the dead hand of academia. Because people write, they're looking to make careers. You can't write this book. It gets nowhere with the academic world. It's not what they want.
Yeah. In 5 years. I mean, 5 years you said you gave to this, right?
So that's, at least 5 years.
And so much scavenger hunting, so much digging, and you had a lot of points of reference to use bibliographies, but were there those hidden gems, those jewels that you did not expect to find that burst out of your seat when you found?
I didn't know what I was going to find when I started, and some of it is absolutely riveting. You really get very, very close to the subject.
And so, how did slaveholders manage to balance their religious beliefs with the cruel facts of the peculiar institution?
That's very, very interesting. I have a whole chapter on the apologists, how they managed to talk themselves mm-hmm. into the idea. They said, slavery is rather a pity about slavery, but it's a necessary evil. We mm-hmm. have to have it. How are we going to manage it? Then they taught themselves to saying it was a positive good. And that's a huge leap to say that slavery was not only good for the owners, but it was also very beneficial to the slaves themselves, because they were very like, so they, if left alone, they were childlike. They couldn't manage their own lives.
Accused of hypocrisy.
Yeah. So also as slaves, they become Christians. That was a great line they took, that they got the great benefit of, there were bishops who said this.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned academia briefly, and I wonder if you have any thoughts on slave owners and the legacy of slavery in American universities.
Oh, well, that's not really my topic. I know I'm not qualified to say have an opinion. I have an opinion on it, but you start doing that, where is it going to end?
Yeah.
There is no pretty much hard to find money that's not corrupted in some way.
Sure.
In the past.
Well, the legacy of founding fathers is now has been reevaluated for some time now because of slavery. Thomas Jefferson, for example.
Oh yeah.
How does that fit into this book? Does this book sort of illuminate that reevaluation?
Well, Jefferson sort of passed by. Rather, I feel he was an awful hypocrite, but that's mm-hmm. just my opinion. But
and not alone, right? I mean, this is
Patrick Henry was another who said, give me liberty or give me death. But then he said, slaves is bad, but I can't manage without them.
Mm-hmm. So how do you think, having worked on this for so long, how do you think the normalization of slavery that you sort of characterized during this heyday compared to race relations in the U.S. today?
Well, that's a very interesting question. What is the relationship between slavery and racism?
Mm-hmm.
Because racism existed extensively at the same time as in the North.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is often forgotten that, although abolition had its home, the North was extreme. Many people were extremely prejudiced against black people. Frederick Douglass, when he went to visit Boston, he was not allowed to go into the zoo. Mm-hmm. They couldn't ride on streetcars. And Henry Ward Beecher, in one of his sermons, made the point that black people in New York couldn't send their kids to the schools. They couldn't get any decent jobs. They had a very hard time.
Mm-hmm.
This was in the North, so by the South regarded them as being sanctimonious hypocrites.
Mm-hmm. How do you think that narrative prevailed? How do you think we have this sort of misinformation, historical misinformation, this stark divide between the North and the South?
Well, yeah, I was starting to read about that because academic historians have a lot to answer for, because for a long, long time, mm-hmm. the standard historians, like people like James Ford Rhodes, who the earlier part of the 20s, they wrote in an extremely prejudiced way about slavery and about black women. William Dunning was another. And only really in about the last 50 years has the study been, study of slavery and place of black people in this country being treated in an impartial way.
So, you know, there are some very well-known abolitionists, Frederick Douglass, John Brown. Tell us about some of those that are sort of buried in the history books that, that come out in this book.
I'm sorry?
Tell us about abolitionists that we might not know as well. Oh,
William Lloyd Garrison. You didn't mention him. So, he, for example, he was nearly lynched by a mob in Boston who was upset because he was his campaign against slavery was detrimental to business. And so a group of respectable Boston citizens grabbed him and they were going to lynch him. But he was fortunately saved. There were lots and lots of other people who worked as paid speakers traveling around. A very harsh, dangerous job to lecture on slavery.
And what were their arguments they presented? What were the reasons? How did they frame the argument?
Dramatically, usually. They were very often ex-slaves, telling their personal stories. They would tell how to describe floggings and whippings, the brutality that they had to endure, and how their children were sold away and their wives were sold away, and there's nothing at all that they could do about it. It was a horrible business, and so you can't go far wrong describing it as it was.
Can you talk about the Southern journalist Edward Pollard?
Pollard,
who lamented the supremacy of the Northern cause and people, who were, as he put it, coarse and inferior in comparison with the with the chivalry of the South.
Oh yeah, well that's another little myth that the Southern came up with was their chivalry. Yeah. They thought that they were the heirs of the English cavaliers, with their ruffs and their spurring across the plain with their drawn swords. But they weren't like that at all. It was just imagine they got a lot of it out of Walter Scott. They talked themselves into this. Yeah. The idea they had this, second only to ancient Athens. Athens was the civilization that the South produced on the basis of slavery, but that was nonsense.
I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Noel Ray about his book, The Great Stain, Witnessing American Slavery from Overlook Press. How important were slaves during the Civil War?
Very. That's another thing that was often ignored by historians of the Civil War. What a huge part black soldiers played in that war. Not just the famous, that movie they made, Glory of the 54th Massachusetts Regiment, but lots and lots and lots of slaves were in very many battles.
What are some other battles?
Port Hudson, Vicksburg. Can I stop there?
But it was not only on the North, right? So, I mean, there were some involved with the South as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, a small number, but a very small number. But the South contemplated recruiting slaves as soldiers, but it was so contrary to the idea of the status of the black person, they couldn't get around to doing it. And only at the very, very end, they say, all right, we'll enlist slaves as soldiers, but the war was over by then.
You've noted the economic cost of slavery, tying up an enormous quantity of capital that would otherwise have gone into hiring labor and enriching economy as a whole, by virtue of which, and this is a quote from your book, the whole country would have been advanced at least a century beyond its present condition. That's a tremendous assertion. Talk about that a little bit more.
Well, yeah, but that was true, but the trouble was that they were stuck with it. That no person from the North was ever going to go and work in the South on a cotton plantation because the conditions were horrible. I'm sorry.
The idea that we would be advanced at least a century beyond the present conditions, it's quite a separation. That's quite a difference. What are the factors? Where paint a picture for us. Where would we be?
They're buying their labor in advance. You pay for a slave. Normally, you pay a person at the end of the week. The slave owners buying all their labor up front. So of course it was very capital intensive. It required a huge amount of money, and then the slaves had to be insured and fed. So it was a bad economic deal. But as Jefferson said, they have the wolf by the ears. They couldn't let him go. What were they going to do? How were they going to grow their cotton without slaves? Because there are many, many laws saying you cannot emancipate a slave in the South. Mm-hmm. It was made it very, very difficult to do. If a slave was emancipated, he had to leave the state.
Going back to the Civil War, why do you think the cause of the Civil War is still such a contentious idea today?
Well, that's because partly what Pollard did was the myth of the lost cause. He said it wasn't about slavery at all. He said the Civil War was about the fact there were two different societies, entirely, so different that the slavery was just a minor aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
So and that aspect of it has remained. The South cultivates, it seems to me, this rather false memory of what the war was about.
And there's big culture war over statues from the war and the Confederate flag.
Yes.
What does the Confederate flag actually symbolize?
I'm not quite sure because I can't speak to that because it doesn't symbolize anything particularly much to me.
Yeah.
I do know about the statues. Particularly the statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was there's several statues of him. He's a general in the Confederate mm-hmm. Army, and he was the founder of the Ku Klux Klan, and so that's a pretty awful thing to be in, I think.
Yeah. So having been immersed in these pages and all these contemporaneous writings. What has been your sort of personal reaction to that debate that's been playing out over statues and the flag over the recent months and years?
Yeah, well, it doesn't touch me personally because I live up here in the North, and so I have no idea, and I don't have these emotional attachments that people in the South have to the statues and what they represent for good or ill.
Mm-hmm. And is it true that most Southern whites didn't own slaves, even though they defended the practice?
Yes, that's absolutely right. The poor whites were conned. Uh-huh. It was the slave-owning oligarchs who absolutely ran everything in the South, and it was in their interest to keep slavery, and they told the poor whites that they may not have much, but they were superior to the black people. And the poor whites bought that story,
mm-hmm.
and that was the one thing they clung to, was their sense of racial superiority, which is why they were so dismayed at emancipation.
Mm-hmm. And it's sort of somewhat of a strange question, but is there such thing as a good slave owner in the context
yes.
of your book? And some
yes,
of the...
there was. I included in my book the story of a man called Colonel Dabney, and he was a very high-minded person who really looked after his slaves, and did. And he was the ideal slave owner, and if you accept the idea, but they weren't free.
Mm-hmm.
That was one thing. It never occurred to him that he was depriving them of their freedom. He treated them very well. All that could be done for them, he did. And sacrificed himself at the Civil War, too. He wanted to free them, but he couldn't afford to. But at any rate, he was the good guy. But even the best, they were still not free.
I remember an account in the book of a young female slave whose intelligence was recognized early, and she was given a chance to become literate.
Which one was that?
I don't remember her name, but yeah, she did. There was a portrait of her as well in the book.
Phyllis Wheatley.
Yes, of course.
Yes, the Ethiopian poetess, as they called her.
Yes.
She's a very attractive person. She was the best known black person in this country in the 18th century. She was an academic poet.
Yes.
Her poems are rather tortured, but pretty good when you take into account the conditions of the time and how poetry then was written.
Right.
Nowadays, it seems very stilted.
Mm-hmm.
But in her day, she was renowned, and she was sent to London and made much of, and presented to the Lord Mayor and all that. But she had a very sad life because she died very early and was very poor, and her books didn't get published again.
Were there important figures in terms of preserving her work and making sure that it survives today?
Since then, I don't know. Well, she's been taken up, of course, because mm-hmm. she was a remarkable case.
Mm-hmm.
She was very lucky. She had a very kindly family who recognized her intelligence and her creativity, and let her have free rein. She was treated as a member of the household, not as a servant.
Mm-hmm. You know, a listener on Twitter is asking that we use the term enslaved Africans instead of slaves. That slave is a dehumanizing term. Do you agree with that? Or
no, I don't see it. That's a distinction without a difference, isn't it?
Uh-huh. Well, I think each perspective is valid, but certainly you have yours after having been looking at this for so very long. I've been speaking with Noel Ray about his latest book, This Great Stain, Witnessing American Slavery. Thank you so very much for joining me today.
Thank you.